Here's the sound, especially during the summer months when you can see a little bit more, get an idea of what we're really talking about when they say the oil is washing up on the beaches, what the area looks like. That will be followed by very brief presentations by representatives of both local, statewide, and national environmental organizations. And then we will open it up to questions. Thank you. Jim Lethkow of the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance will be starting with the slides.
Yes, I'd like to say just a few things. Most of the discussion so far has been economic questions regarding Prince William Sound. But for some of us who use the sound, who boat, sail, kayak, hike in the sound, it's impossible to place any kind of economic value on our loss. I don't think all of Exxon's billions can in any way compensate us for what we've lost. And I'd like to just, so that press here, people who are not familiar with the area, can get an understanding of why you've seen a lot of emotional outburst, a lot of outrage with respect to what's happened to Prince William Sound. So I'm just going to run through some slides. This will perhaps help you. I know most of you have just been looking at maps, and it's kind of an abstraction, but I hope this will bring down to you what we're really talking about here, what the environment that this oil is destroying looks like. So I'll just run through these slides very briefly.
Dr. Jim Lethkow, who is a resident of Valdez and is a fairly renowned biological scientist and a lecturer at Prince William Sound Community College, is showing a series of slides basically that show the mountains and waterways, waterfalls of Prince William Sound. The preface, as you just heard, was to point out the fact that there is a value to the sound that cannot be measured in strictly in economic terms. Again, you're listening to KCHU Radio in Valdez, Alaska, in the Alaska Public Radio Network, as we're presenting a press conference hosted by a consortium of environmental interests, the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance, Trustees for Alaska, Earth First, Greenpeace, and the Sierra Club. We have received notification today that the Exxon press conference will be at 6 o'clock this evening, not 5 o'clock, and that the evening's NOAA conference has been scheduled. The slides we're showing show various seasons and weather conditions, the wildlife, the mountains. Very hard to depict this presentation over the radio. For those who are listening in Alaska and who have traveled through Prince William Sound, of course, it is one of the most spectacular wilderness areas in coastal Alaska that is largely undeveloped. Throughout much of Prince William Sound is national forest or other parklands. That's Dr. Jim Lethkow with the slides, and now I believe the press briefing will continue from the Environmental Consortium.
We appreciate that. Jim and I have been here 22 years sailing in Prince William Sound. We've lived year-round in the Sound for 5 years. Our daughter did her high school by correspondence, and it hurts us very, very much to see what's happening. I'm Nancy Lethkow, Jim's wife. L-E-T-H-C-O-E. The slides I'm going to show are just selected from our collection to try to illustrate some of our thoughts that go through our mind when we listen to Exxon talking about cleaning up the beaches of Prince William Sound. I think as you look at these, you realize the enormity and, sadly, the utter impossibility of doing this. Somewhere there's going to have to be a decision made on what is the criteria for calling a beach clean and when we move into rehabilitation. Prince William Sound has many rocky coastlines. Different types of rocky coastlines are utilized by many animals. This is, of course, a sea lion haul-out. This is an area that I believe has been now impacted by oil. There's another sea lion haul-out on Perry Island. They're used primarily in the winter time and this time of the year. In the summertime, they're more on the around the sound in various areas and on the buoys, as Jim showed you. The sea lions, of course, we've had many encounters with. The sea lion that played with our kayak and eventually landed in our kayak one day. The Harbor seals are another important marine mammal. Unlike the sea lions, they cannot jump up onto the rocks. They perch on a rock and wait for the tide to go out around them. They're particularly susceptible to the oil. You can see the harbor seal. Many of the bird rookeries are in very rocky, exposed areas, and birds, of course, are pelagic. They feed on small fish. This is another down by Green Island, a bird rookery island. There are many of these bird rookery islands. You can see the black lines along the shoreline in some of these places. So the birds, many of them nest very close to the upper intertidal zone or spray zone. This is an example of a typical cliff in Prince William Sound. I don't know how one cleans this up. I mean, you can't stand in a raft and scrub it. It just seems impossible. And yet the marine life that grows on a cliff, that lives on a cliff like this, is extremely important to the fertility of the entire food chain in Prince William Sound. You see, this is the egg-laying season is now, the plankton season is now. The phytoplankton, the plant plankton are blooming, and soon the animal plankton is blooming is into the food column, and is what supports the whales, particularly our baleen whales. We have a very strong population of humpback whales, some fin whales, that feed in Prince William Sound. Our beaches are also sort of rocks, boulders, and cobbles with headlands, oops, upside down headlands, rocks that have rolled for ages up and down those beaches, scouring them, smoothing them. Pocket beaches are everywhere, just little nooks. And when they talk about moving oil into a protected area and containing it in there, those are our fertile areas, those are our breaches, those are our anchorages. You see the different sizes of the rocks that have to be cleaned up. I don't know what constitutes being cleaned up, but the tides go in and out twice a day. Are they going to clean the beaches, all 2,000 miles of them, twice a day? It's unbelievable. The beaches are not only used by marine animals and birds, but also deer come down to the upper spray zone. This is an intertidal zone. The plants that are down in the rocks are actually in the upper intertidal zone. They're saltwater tolerant plants. They're important plants in the spring for the Sitka deer that feed on them down in the shoreline. Next. You know, we have over 2,000 salmon streams that are cataloged. We have many more salmon streams that are not cataloged. 60 to 70% of the pink salmon, which is a major commercial species, spawn in the intertidal zone from 0 to 15 foot level. This is a typical intertidal zone spawning area. It's also, of course, used by many birds, shorebirds. It's used by people. It's used by salmon in the streams. You can see here the tide line on the stream where the salmon are spawning. The salmon, of course, support the fishing industry. They support the tourism industry. They support the black bears in Prince William Sound. If the salmon do not return, it'll have a very adverse effect on the black bear population. If the salmon do not return, it'll have an adverse effect on the killer whales who feed in Prince William Sound. We have, I think, I've forgotten the figure. I think it's about 290 killer whales have been photographed using Prince William Sound. The killer whales, although they do feed on marine mammals, the killer whales in Prince William Sound in the summertime feed primarily on fish, notably salmon. The Dall's porpoise. We have many Dall's porpoise in Prince William Sound. I think the number is between 2,000 and 3,000. They also feed on fish. One of our concerns is we keep hearing people mention tent sites for housing the people who are cleaning up the beaches. This is what you're seeing right now when you fly over the area. But these do not cover dry meadows. These cover peatland bogs. They're very sensitive areas, they're very damp areas, they're not suitable places to put tent sites or tent communities. We also wonder who's going to take care of the sewage, who's going to take care of the garbage, and we really believe that any cleanup personnel should be housed aboard ships, not on the shoreline or if they are housed on the shoreline, arrangements should be made to rent and pay the Chugach Native Corporation and villages for use of their private lands. These are some photographs that Lynn Crystal was kind enough to bring me. This is some of the areas that have been hit by the oil. This is looking down on the north end of Night Island. You can see it. This is Naked Island, where the oil was first coming ashore. And this is Seal Rock, another example of a very important wildlife area that has been impacted by. That's all I have, and thank you for coming.
Next, I'd like to introduce Nan Eagleson, who is the board, president board for the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance.
Good afternoon. The Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance wishes to thank Governor Cowper for promising immediate and adequate financial support to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and Alaska Division of Fish and Game to assess the damage done to the Sound's marine environment, habitats, and fisheries. We also thank Commissioner Dennis Kelso and all the state and federal employees for their immediate and highly professional response to the environmental catastrophe that has befallen our beloved Prince William Sound. And finally, we thank Chuck Hamill for the warnings and efforts he has made since 1985 to help us safeguard the Sound from oil pollution. We sadly recognize that Prince William Sound as a pristine marine environment has been lost. As we grieve, we try not to look back to the past, but forward to the future. In this light, the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance has the following concerns and suggestions. We would like assurance that the cleanup crews will be housed and supervised in such a manner that they do not themselves contribute to the environmental disaster. We suggest that any tent facilities be placed on private lands and not in the Chugach National Forest, and that the Department of Environmental Conservation receive adequate funding to monitor them for sewage and garbage disposal. We would like assurance that adequate funding be sought to establish a long-term assessment project to evaluate the impact of a cold water oil spill on the marine and coastal environment. An independent team of experts from government agencies and the public should be established to oversee and evaluate all short and long-term assessments of the environmental damage to the Sound, including those undertaken and funded by Exxon. We would like assurance that there is adequate funding for long-term rehabilitation efforts for the Sound. We would like Congress to begin an immediate investigation of the environmental record for the pipeline supertanker route to determine if the original intent of Congress to protect Alaska's sensitive natural resources has been met, and if not, to determine what steps need to be taken to obtain that protection. We would like Congress to cancel any offshore oil lease sales in Alaska and to postpone hearings on the opening up of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge until the congressional investigation is complete and any resulting recommendations for additional environmental safeguards and funding for monitoring and enforcement are in place. We would like any future oil development in Alaska to be contingent upon the successful cleanup and long-term rehabilitation of Prince William Sound. We deplore the Coast Guard decision of August 31, 1987, which directed the vessel traffic system traffic watch standards to only plot vessels between Entrance Island and Tongue Point and to discontinue their 6-minute plots from Tongue Point to Abim Bly Reef Buoy. We want the Coast Guard to reinitiate plotting of TAPS vessels in the VTS traffic lanes and to install 100% radar coverage of the vessel traffic system. Thank you.
I'd like to introduce Cindy Lowry, the Alaska Regional Director with Greenpeace.
Says Cindy, C-I-N-D-Y, Lowry, L-O-W-R-Y. Well, it's clear by the slides that you've just seen the future viability of a myriad of marine mammals, seabird, fish, and terrestrial species are in jeopardy. We may be able to document the impact of oil on species such as sea otters and sea lions that haul out, but what about dolls and harbor porpoise and whales? These species can't haul out and certainly don't have oil trajectory maps to navigate by around the spill. While Exxon has set up a claims process whereby fishermen can try to retrieve some of their economical losses, how do you place a dollar figure on a marine mammal or seabird? What is the worth of an endangered humpback whale? Greenpeace is asking that the oil industry fund a habitat recovery program for both future habitat cleanup of Prince William Sound and research into the wildlife populations that have been impacted. In the meantime, the Bush administration should shut down tanker traffic into the sound until the oil is recovered and halt oil leasing in biologically sensitive areas. The oil industry's arrogance and insensitivity towards the environment can no longer be tolerated. I might also add that I was a member of the Department of Interior's Wildlife Protection Working Group that developed guidelines for cleaning up oil wildlife in Alaska. My contribution dealt mainly with coordinating information on equipment and materials needed for cleanup. This contingency plan was adopted last December 88. While I recommended adoption of those guidelines, I did so with one caveat, that the equipment and materials needed for response efforts be stockpiled in key areas of biologically sensitive areas around the state. This is the only way for this contingency plan to be truly effective. However, my suggestion was not adopted by the Alaska Regional Response Team. This ecological nightmare makes it clear why it's so imperative to have a stockpiling on site. And while it's true rehabilitation facilities have been established, when I visited those bird and sea otter facilities yesterday, I did not see any equipment set up. I found absolutely nothing behind the door marked sea otter room. I will be asking the state to adopt regulations making this type of stockpiling mandatory. Thanks.
My name is Hild Sandsted, and I'm the offshore oil drilling campaigner for Greenpeace. It's Hild, H-I-L-D. The last name is Sandsted, S-A-N-D-S-T-E-D-E. This oil spill brings to a head our worst fear associated with offshore oil drilling in Alaskan waters. In a letter dated March 20th, 1989, just 4 days before the worst spill in U.S. history, Greenpeace received a letter from the Department of the Interior stating, "Industry has presently demonstrated its ability to respond to oil spills during Arctic conditions through oil spill response drills and training exercises. We believe that oil spill cleanup capabilities for the environmental conditions expected on the Chukchi Sea are similar to or better than those for temperate conditions. It has been clearly demonstrated to the entire world during the course of this oil spill that industry has no adequate containment and or cleanup capabilities to oil spills. During the critical early hours of the spill, when unusually calm weather would have aided in containing the spill, Alyeska and Exxon spent those precious moments flying in experts and equipment that should have been here. There are a number of lingering questions that need to be answered by the Exxon and Alyeska people. Did Alyeska have properly trained staff? Why was proper equipment required by the contingency plan not available? Why was some of that equipment that was purchased by Alyeska in Seattle? Why had the deployment barge not been repaired for over 1 year? And why did Exxon discount the ability and knowledge of local fishermen to aid in early containment as well as forecasting weather and sea conditions? The local fishermen are the experts in plying and understanding these waters, and they have made themselves available to whatever needs to be done. Exxon did not respond to their offer and has not paid heed to their wisdom and experience in these waters. It is apparent that the containment and cleanup measures of this spill has been a travesty. The use of dispersants and burning is not an acceptable way to deal with an oil spill. It adds insult to injury. The spill should never have happened. This is the fourth spill in Alaskan waters associated with the oil industry in the last 3 months. Two of those, there was no cleanup effort attempted. One was due to ice conditions. If a spill cannot be cleaned or contained in relatively calm waters, how then can industry respond to their cleanup needs for offshore oil drilling in sensitive areas like the Chukchi and Bristol Bay? Greenpeace is asking the environmental president, George Bush, to curtail all offshore drilling and leasing activities in Alaskan waters. Thank you.
Listening to a live broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom in Valdez, Alaska. We just heard about an hour ago an Exxon company press conference. Now there is a conference briefing established by a coalition of environmental activist groups. We've been hearing from...
Hi, my name is Mike Wenig, W-E-N-I-G. I'm a staff attorney with Trustees for Alaska, which is a nonprofit environmental law firm based in Anchorage. I have two perspectives to share with you today. The first is that we at Trustees were not surprised by this spill because we've been following oil industry compliance with environmental laws throughout the state, and this just represents perhaps the worst example of a pattern of disregard for environmental concerns. We've got uncontrolled air emissions at the Alaska terminal. We've got unpermitted air emissions from drilling operations in Cook Inlet. We go to the Kenai Peninsula. There are hundreds of waste sites from drilling operations there. We move up to Prudhoe Bay. We find hazardous waste discharged in unlined reserve pits and waste being discharged onto the tundra from those reserve pits, either without federal permits or with permits and consistent violations of the permits. So for us, this is perhaps the worst example we've seen to date, but it's certainly not the only one, and it was to be expected. The other perspective I have comes from having sat and listened to these press conferences since Saturday and not having had the kinds of deadlines that you've had and having somewhat of a chance to look over this, to step back and look at this. And what's become pretty clear is the bottom line, when all the smoke is cleared away, the oil industry's bottom line is that this catastrophe was an acceptable cost of doing business in Alaska, or as it was said yesterday, this is the price we pay for fueling our Mercedes-Benzes down in the lower 48. Well, if that's really the bottom line, then the oil companies should own up to it, and when we have public debates on future oil development elsewhere in Alaska, that should be the issue and not the issue of whether the oil companies can adequately conduct their activities and at the same time preserve the pristine environments. Just in conclusion, I'd like to say that when the oil wells dry up and the oil industry packs up and goes, we've got to ask ourselves what's going to be left of this state for our children and grandchildren. Thank you.
My name's Rex Blazer, R-E-X, B-L-A-Z-E-R. I'm the executive director of the Northern Alaska Environmental Center in Fairbanks. A month ago, I sat on the lawn of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. at a press conference and told a very small crowd about our very real concerns about whether we were hearing the truth from the oil industry in regards to oil spill response technology and the real assessment of effects from oil exploration in Alaska, particularly Bristol Bay and the sensitive waters in the Arctic, and indeed the truth about the impacts of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge contained in the Fish and Wildlife Service's 1002 report. It's a very sad fact that we're all here today to speak to that truth or lack thereof. Business as usual for these oil companies has obviously not been good enough to protect the environment here in southern Alaska. As a group concerned largely with the northern part of the state, we know damn well that business as usual will not be good enough to protect the Arctic ecosystem in the harsh conditions and ice conditions that exist up there. Therefore, we need a real, demonstrable, and verifiable change in the way the oil company deals with the public and those federal agencies under this administration deals with the public in terms of assessing these impacts. We are calling for a ban, a permanent ban on drilling in Bristol Bay, a moratorium on all state and federal oil exploration in offshore waters until a reassessment is completed by an independent scientific body of the impacts and oil spill response technologies for those areas, focusing particularly on the areas around the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Karen Jetmar, J-E-T-T-M-A-R. I'm the Alaska Regional Associate for the Wilderness Society in Anchorage. I'd like to begin with a quote from Stuart Udall, former Secretary of the Interior. In the 1960s, he said, "In Alaska, we have a magnificent opportunity to show more respect for wilderness and wildlife values than our forebears. The wonders of wilderness abound there. If we spoil them, we cannot excuse their defilement with pleas of ignorance." Prince William Sound, one of our nation's richest biologically diverse aquatic ecosystems, has now been defiled, and there's simply no excuse. The oil companies have orchestrated a sophisticated public relations strategy to keep the problems of oil and gas development hidden from view. Wake up, America. The alarm has sounded. Regardless of what the oil industry promises, there is no guarantee against disaster. No matter how much preparation, no matter how many safety precautions are taken, no matter how many promises are made, you're going to routinely have catastrophic accidents and environmental disasters. There have been over 400 oil spills in Port Valdez alone since the Alyeska pipeline began transporting oil. If we don't have the capability to protect critical areas, then we cannot afford to drill for oil in sensitive environments. No amount of preparation can eliminate human error. 2 months ago, the leading conservation organizations asked President Bush to reverse the Reagan administration's decision to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. We've asked for a full review of the Department of Interior's 1002 report regarding oil development on the 1.5 million acre Arctic coastal plain. The Department of Interior violated the law and the public trust by failing to produce an accurate, complete, objective report to Congress. The 1002 report failed to include all reasonable alternatives, including energy conservation. President Bush claims to be an environmentalist, yet he calls for prudent development in the Arctic. We're asking the President to fulfill his campaign pledge to protect the environment and to establish a sound energy policy. Development of the Arctic Refuge will mean an irrevocable loss to one of our great remaining wilderness and wildlife resources, all for a few months of oil that is readily available elsewhere. There is no such thing as prudent development. A 1.5 million acre wilderness would be covered by a network of hundreds of miles of roads, gravel pads, airstrips, hundreds of exploratory wells, waste pits, gravel mines, housing for hundreds of people, and two ports on the Beaufort Sea. By a policy as simple as establishing fuel efficiency standards in this country of 45 miles per gallon for cars and 35 miles per gallon for light trucks by 1995, we could save 5 times the amount of oil which is reportedly in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. By using energy as efficiently as the Japanese, we could save 200 billion gallons of oil per year. We need to be developing alternative energy technology to break this nation's addiction to oil. The fight over protecting the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and the world's only remaining intact and complete sample of high Arctic ecosystem is not simply to protect that area. This is a litmus test for the administration. Only by defending all of our parks, all of our refuges, and all of our wilderness areas against development and by leading our country through the essential transitions needed for sound energy policy, will President Bush prove to be a protector of this world's environment? What does Prince William Sound teach us? That we cannot afford to take a chance in the Arctic and other critically environmentally sensitive areas.
Good afternoon. I'm Jack Heshin, Alaska representative of the Sierra Club in Anchorage. That's H-E-S-S-I-O-N. I'd like to briefly take exception with some Exxon statements that you've all heard, that there's no relationship between what's happening here and the industry's plans for development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Yesterday, for example, Mr. Cornett, and I'm quoting, said that, quote, ANWR and this incident, it's a nice word for the disaster, by the way, are unrelated, unquote. On the contrary, I believe there's a direct and immediate relationship between the two occurrences. In the early 1970s, for those of us who remember that, we heard from the industry that it's perfectly safe to ship oil down the West Coast in supertankers. Do not worry, they said. Trust us. If there's ever those of us can remember that, we heard from the industry that it's perfectly safe to ship oil down the West Coast in supertankers. Do not worry, they said. Trust us. If there's ever a spill, we'll clean it up effectively and speedily. Well, you can all see what a sham that argument was. And now we're being asked to believe that industry can move into the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, one of the world's pristine wildlife habitats, into the very heart of the refuge, with little or no risk to the unique wildlife and the wilderness values there. I submit that we're getting the same song and dance on the Arctic as the industry gave us here back in the early 1970s. Conservationists and fishermen then didn't believe the industry, and we don't believe them now. And I think this disaster, this tragedy, this violent pollution of Prince William Sound should open the eyes of Congress and the American public to the industry smokescreen on the Arctic. Thank you very much.
On behalf of me back again, I'm Nancy Lefko, and I'm the Alaskan representative for the American Wilderness Alliance. The American Wilderness Alliance is a national, nonprofit, educational, recreational, and conservation organization. We have sponsored educational outdoor vacations in Alaska for the past 7 years, including annual week-long trips in Prince William Sound. We are filled with anger and an overwhelming sadness at the loss of Prince William Sound. In a few thoughtless minutes, following hours and perhaps years of complacency and unpreparedness, one more portion of our country's most productive coastline has been polluted beyond recognition. It is a loss of unsurpassed national magnitude, a loss that this country and the world can ill afford. The time has come for the establishment of a procedure for declaring national environmental emergencies. We ask that Congress set up a fund to cover the costs of immediate responses to environmental emergencies, cleanup, assessment, and rehabilitation.
My favorite bumper sticker states, "Mother Nature bats last," and I have that role today. Well, as we've seen, I'm Mike Lewis with Earth First. I'm a Valdez resident, but I also happen to be speaking for some global issues from the Earth First perspective. Our underlying philosophy is no compromise in defense of Mother Earth, and that's what we are here today. L-E-W-I-S. The entire North Slope development was based on promises by the oil companies that they could do their thing safely and they could transport their oil through our lands and waters without destroying the environment. Well, we've now seen the lie of all those promises. The oil companies have been caught with their pants down and the whole world is looking through the outhouse door. This agreement was between the oil companies and the people of Alaska and of the United States. We now declare this agreement null and void. We are no longer bound by any agreements, and we would make the following demands. Since Alyeska and the owner companies cannot guarantee the safety of the oil tanker fleets, tanker traffic through Prince William Sound to the Alyeska Pipeline Terminal Facility must be stopped immediately. Since there exists no method of safely moving oil through the environmentally sensitive lands and waters of Alaska, the Trans-Alaska Pipeline must be shut down immediately. Since the oil companies have demonstrated an inability to develop oil without severely damaging the environment, all consideration of development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and Bristol Bay must be discontinued and those areas declared a national wilderness. The people and the wildlife of Prince William Sound are backed up against the wall, and I remind you what happens to a grizzly bear when it's cornered. It fights back. Earth first.
Hello, my name is Lisa Rotterman. The last name is spelled R-O-T-T-E-R-M-A-N. I'm a sea otter biologist. I work with the University of Minnesota and Alaska Pacific University under contract to Prince William Sound. I'll try and make this very brief. If anyone wants more information about data, I'll be happy to talk to them afterwards. Myself and a colleague of mine named Chuck Monette have been working on a long-term research project for the past 6 years of sea otters in Prince William Sound, primarily looking more in the area around Cordova. So when this happened, Chuck was on the scene in Cordova and got in the air and started flying early Friday morning, and we've basically been flying ever since. If what I have to say is a little disjointed, it's because we're going on about 2 hours sleep a night. We've been flying surveys out of Cordova, so we've been up every day because we haven't had the problems with the winds that some of the other researchers have had, and we've been flying surveys for all marine mammals in Prince William Sound. And what our approach is to fly before the spill, survey what's there, and then survey after the spill, with the idea being that's pretty much the only way to get a handle on what's going to happen to what happens to the marine mammals as a result of this spill. Sea otters are the most vulnerable marine mammal to oiling because they depend entirely on their pelt for thermoregulation. About a little over 10%, 10 to 20% oiling, and they're dead. We expect this to have terribly severe ramifications on the sea otter population here, possibly its total extinction. Just real briefly, I'll try to point out why we think that's particularly significant. Sea otters were just about wiped out at the turn of the century. There were 11 remnant populations which are still represented today that survived, and the population in Prince William Sound is one of those. Because of the genetic ramifications, all those little remnants got very small, and there was a lot of inbreeding, and basically they went through what is called a genetic bottleneck. The population in Prince William Sound, we've now studied four of the remnant groups in Alaska and the group in California. The population in Prince William Sound has significantly more variability than any of the other four populations we've looked at, and it is also a unique genetic stock. So this population is not replaceable. If it is wiped out, basically you can't just ship animals in from somewhere else. It is differentiated from its two nearest remnant populations, that's Kodiak and California. Right now, the oil spill has not yet impacted the areas, as far as I know. I haven't flown yet this morning. It hasn't impacted the areas where there are high densities of sea otters, although it is poised right now and may have already reached it this morning. Green Island, Port Chalmers, and Stockdale Harbor areas of Montague Island. Those are very important rearing areas. It's probably the most important pupping area for this entire half of the sound. And we expect mortality to be just about total if the oil hits there. Just to give you an example, we flew Naked Island a couple days ago, found 58 sea otters there. This was before heavy oiling hit. We flew yesterday and there were none, and we are pretty sure that was mortality. It's not likely that oiled otters are going to be able to, that this population is going to be able to be saved through rehabilitation, although I greatly support those efforts. The reason being is that oiled otters sink and they die very, very quickly, so the the time before between oiling and death is very, very short. Mm-hmm. And with the logistics in Prince William Sound and the areas, the remoteness of the areas, I think people are going to have a pretty tough time rehabilitating or getting otters to rehabilitate in this particular situation. Now, what we're primarily worried about is the possibility of the oil spill, which we think is a real good possibility, stretching over the entire sound and eventually reaching Orca Inlet, which is the area where the highest densities of sea otters in the entire world has been reported, 75 to 100 otters per square kilometer in some areas.
That's Orca Inlet?
Orca Inlet, right. That's the area over near Cordova. With westerlies, which are very common this time of year, we expect oil to reach the Sheep Bay areas, the Hell's Hole area, which is another important pupping area, etc. The other point I would like to make with respect to sea otters is I don't think we even know how bad the oil is yet. As of yesterday, we flew. There was still oil coming out of the tanker. I had this confirmed. We saw a plume from above. As I say, we're flying every day. I've had it confirmed that there was some, so I don't think we can say that this is a spill of a certain magnitude because there is still oil coming out. And we're particularly concerned that the entire cargo could be released into the sound. Just real quickly on a couple other marine mammals, we've seen orcas surfacing in the crude. People were wondering whether any other marine mammals might avoid this stuff. There doesn't seem to be a lot of evidence for that. The main plume is now moving into areas where there are extremely high densities of stellar sea lions. We've seen over 300 stellars in oil. There were over 600 stellars hauled out at a place called the Needle, and the plume will reach that. I mean, it's directly in its path. All of our estimates, one just short thing, all of our estimates for numbers of animals affected are definitely underestimates because we're not flying under ideal conditions. We know what we count is there, but we're missing a tremendous number of animals.
Where did you see the sea lions in the oil?
We saw sea lions in the oil in an area called Smith Island. Let me look at my notes here.
Stellar,
after a naturalist.
And when was that?
Russian naturalist. We saw sea lions in oil at Naked Islands. And to give you an example of sea lions, on March 25th, we saw 91 sea lions at Naked Island. We flew yesterday after serious oiling had hit, and we saw 8. We don't know with respect to sea lions whether that's mortality. Yesterday, there were 136 at Smith Island in extremely heavy, coal black, real thick oil.
How many?
136 that we counted.
Where?
A place called Smith Island. It's a tiny little rock that just kind of sticks up in the
middle. Were they all covered with oil?
They did not appear. It's very hard to tell whether they oiled from the air. They were not black.
A question of clarification. You touched on it, but if you can give me a sort of shorter answer encompassing this. A lot of people expect to see many animals, dozens, hundreds of animals washing up on the shore, and because they haven't seen that, they're thinking that maybe the toll hasn't been as great as some other oil spills. Can you give me a sense of what the toll is, even though we don't have tangible evidence?
No, I can't. I think you can assume that most of the sea otters that were in the oiled areas are dead. They just don't withstand oiling. That's all there is to it. I don't think we're going to get a real good handle on the effects of the other animals, except for marine mammals, except for long-term surveys. And the National Marine Fisheries Service people are doing, you know, will be continuing to look at that. We were just looking at those animals because we were up in the air. With respect to the sea otters, if you're looking for carcasses on the beach, I don't think you're going to see them. You'll see some. You'll see a minuscule amount of what dies. As I say, their pelt is what gives them buoyancy. When the pelt is oiled, the limited evidence that there is says they sink. Some of them might haul out before they die, and you might find those, but you're going to be doing this from the air primarily. You're looking for a brown or black dot on a black background.
What do you think the toll is in terms of numbers, just based on your observations?
Well, I really have no estimate right now. Impact on sea otters as the population goes has not been severe yet, because I would say, you know, it's over 100 animals, but the impact on the population per se, which we estimate to be about 10 to 12,000 otters in Prince William Sound, has not been that severe because it's not in the areas of high otter density as of yesterday. It might be right now in Green Island. That's a very important area. If it spreads to the eastern half of the sound, the area around Orca Inlet, they're just gone.
Can you tell me how you feel about the strategy to target three areas where there are hatcheries, a fourth area where there's a sensitive stretch of coastline, and not exactly sacrifice the other areas, but certainly not put as many resources there? How do you feel about
that? Well, we're lobbying to have particular otter areas try to get deflection booms so that oil does not move into those areas. Additionally, we're thinking a massive translocation effort might be necessary. We'll just have to see over the next couple of days. Well, we're not willing to write off this stock.
Some people are saying that the problem is so big, the only way to deal with it effectively with the resources is concentrate on these four quote-unquote sensitive areas. How do you feel about that strategy?
I have to see the sensitive areas. I haven't. We've worked in this sound for 6 years. We have not been consulted with respect to sensitive areas.
I think it means that concentrating on, you know, the interests of commercial fishermen at the expense of natural wildlife. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I obviously think that other interests should be included. I spend my life as a sea otter biologist.
From a practical point of view, isn't a sea otter almost an impossible animal to move and to catch?
Not at all. We've caught hundreds of otters for our research. We can catch them extremely effectively. Unweighted gill nets are very effective. There's no problem at all. You can catch them. It's extremely expensive. Where would they go? What are we going to do? Build a giant swimming pool and hold them for a while until this place cleans up? We don't know when that would be. The oil's going to be around a very long time.
But it sounds like you have, an incredibly difficult logistical problem coping with that many animals that are that hard to catch.
Oh, you're not going to save the population. I mean, if we were, what we would be gearing for, if it looks as if oil is going to enter Orca Inlet and that is unavoidable and that it cannot be protected, we would try to catch enough animals so that the genetic stock could be preserved. And so we'd be looking straight population genetics. How many animals should we catch randomly to ensure the stock? I'd like to get off the stage in case there's any other, I'm sure there's questions for other people. Pardon? Targeting is year-round in sea otters, although there are particular peaks. It's begun. We're having significant numbers of pups born now. It really peaks in April and May. But there are pups out there now. We have a lot of animals that are radio instrumented. They've started having pups already.
Question for Mrs. Lefko. Same question I asked before, but just to put it to someone else. Yesterday we were told about a change in strategy with the cleanup and targeting at four areas, three hatcheries, and one that's supposed to be another sensitive area for fish. And the sense seems to be that they're not paying attention. The problem's so big, you can't put resources everywhere. You have to concentrate in four areas. What's your reaction to that general strategy?
I think it's the only thing they could do. It's not a strategy any of us ever even wanted to consider. But given the limited resources, all we can do is hope that works.
I think tonight at 8 o'clock there's going to be a press conference here made up of the environmental assessment team, which is all these different agencies, and I sat in on that session last night, and they get together every evening and come back and report to each other what they've been doing for the day, and that's exactly where they decide what areas are going to be protected. So if you want, you know, to answer some of those questions on how they determine it, you should speak with them.
Yeah, I want to. Is Greenpeace organizing or will they support a blockade of the Valdez Narrows to prevent any more tanker traffic?
Well, we have talked with some fishermen about different options, and I guess I'm not willing to say what we're going to do at this time.
Would Greenpeace support such an effort?
I think so.
Would Earth First?
You're listening to a live broadcast of a press conference in the Valdez Civic Center, run by a group, a coalition of environmental interests.
Nothing specific, just that when an animal is cornered, it fights back, and there are many, many ways we can fight back. By we, I mean all of the people of the United States. There are many, many options that we have of fighting back, and everyone... The responsibility of this starts with Frank Iorossi personally, and it goes out in expanding ripples to include every one of us. We all have a share of the responsibility for what's happening out there today. We've all made decisions throughout our lives, every single day of our lives, about the use of oil and oil products and driving our cars and using plastics and everything that has to do with the oil. We can all make those decisions as days go on. We can decide not to use oil so much. We can boycott Exxon if we want to do that. We can all fight back in whatever way is possible in our own lives. Some of us may fight back a little harder than others. Some of us may write letters and make phone calls. Some of us may change our lifestyle. But there's one thing for sure, is that it's going to change. There's a finite amount of oil out there. We are driving at 100 miles per hour toward the precipice, and we're going to go off the edge. We have the option right now of changing our course, of diverting some of our energy into the development of renewable resources. If we don't do that now, it'll be too late when we reach the edge. And this is some of the ways we can fight back.
Can I ask you about the pipeline? I went down to the terminal, and it's kind of like a paramilitary organization. There's even a guy in a SWAT team with a shoulder holster, and he said he was protecting the helicopters. I mean, and he wouldn't say from what. You guys?
Aliask is extremely nervous about the facility over there, and always has been. Some months ago, we had a terrorist exercise in Valdez. We were inundated by FBI and CIA agents, SWAT teams. They conducted exercises over at the terminal and in other areas to prepare for a terrorist attack of the Alyeska terminal facility.
What's their thinking? I mean, is that a serious possibility in their view, or is it an intimidation? What's your view?
They spent a lot of money on it. They must think it's serious.
But to what purpose?
If I might add, it's the national security interest. Alaska, apparently, according to the federal government, has quite a few reserves of oil, both in Anwar, which is, I'm sure you've heard of, in the Beaufort Sea, and now they're planning to start drilling in the Chukchi Sea. They have stepped up their drilling and leasing plans and activities full speed ahead, and it is all in the name of our national security interests, and I'm pretty sure that their Alyeska terminal, they're trying to protect that. I don't know who's going to come over here and sabotage it, but it is in the interest of the federal government to protect our oil reserves in the state of Alaska.
Yes, I mean, it's the matter in which you do it.
There's a rumor going around that Exxon has ordered an immediate hiring freeze on people for helping in the cleanup for the next 3 days at least, if not longer. And all I hear so far is everybody's talking about we've got to do something, we've got to do something, yet I see nothing happening, and I'm watching the state getting shafted from all sides, and I'm wondering, is this all that's going to happen, is that while the press is here, everyone will be talking, as soon as the press is gone, everyone will go home and forget that this ever happened? Because if I have to change my lifestyle because the oil companies decided their oil is more important than this planet, something's drastically wrong. Yes, for you or for anybody up there, since you represent all the different groups from up here.
Oh, I just represent my group. There's quite a bit of activity. Right now, our problem with the cleanup is getting out to these areas, there, we don't have all of the equipment that we need. And also, we talked earlier, the Lefkos presented some information concerning the area that we're talking about. The cleanup effort is going to be a very difficult thing. It's just not being mobilized. We're still waiting for supplies to come in, but there's other activities that are taking place. They're more long-range activities, but we will be trying to really put some pressure on Exxon and Alyeska from, well, we have been trying for a long time, but now we have quite a few things to work with. A number of avenues that we can take, getting involved in these task groups, we can get legislation changed. There's all kinds of things that people can do out of this oil spill, but in the immediacy of the event, as far as physical work, getting out there, it's really tough right now, and I'm not working as closely with those people as I probably need to be, but we've got a lot of volunteers sitting out here waiting in buses to go do something. The problem is they don't have the equipment and the transportation to get them out there to do anything.
Well, they have all these planes flying in. There's supposed to be where it is. The National Guard has been put on alert, and that a request has been made for the Army Corps of Engineers to come in and take over from Alyeska for this cleanup, because Alyeska seems to be unwilling or unable to do anything about it. And you can fly over the bay and see nothing happening whatsoever.
I think we agree with you in the frustration of seeing, you know, feeling like there needs to be something done. I think those questions also need to be directed at Coast Guard and at Exxon. And as environmental groups, we do have many volunteers, and our hope is to work on the long-term impacts and in the cleanup and be there when they need people and get them out. I think we all need to, we're working together, and we all need to put pressure on the agencies, on Exxon, to do an effective cleanup.
Yeah. I have a question for Mike Lewis. I'm an Earth First member. And I want to know if we can do something, we can have Ekotage here. I'm for it.
We'll see.
You to maybe tell people how we
can
get
in
touch with
you. As I say, we'll fight back in whatever way we can.
Right, and we are past the point of words, and I'm very emotional about this. Tears don't do any good now. We want to fight back. And also, I'd like people to boycott the restaurants that are feeding these people, the Exxon, Alyeska people. I don't like that. I don't see why we should have to support these people. Another thing for hiring, I was just sitting here talking with two friends who are from upcountry.
Very good. Boycotting restaurants, boycotting these people, boycotting these people. We're all arguing or fighting.
I'm not finished yet. I was sitting here and the gentleman over here was talking about having more people. We need thousands of people out there. I talked with the guy from Alyeska today, and he said I didn't know what I was talking about, that 300 was enough. I don't believe him. Why are these people sitting here? They're not allowed to be hired out. I was talking to two people who went to the job service. They were asked to give urine samples to test for drugs before they were hired. Now, that's unbelievable when the captain of the ship is a drunk. That's all I have
okay.
to say.
Remember, we're dealing with very environmentally
stupid
sensitive...
People.
No, we're dealing with environmentally sensitive areas out there, and we don't want to have mobs of people out tramping around.
No, that's right.
So
we need more
keep that, right,
people
right.
out here, and I don't care how they get
keep
out there.
Keep that perspective.
And the idea that the job service is giving them drug tests is... it's beyond
you
me.
You need to write your senator about that one.
Doesn't do any good. I've read and written
concerns I think that need to be addressed immediately, and I don't think they are, and maybe as environmentalists it's time to band together and address them. One is that
Exxon does not have an immediate response contingency plan if any more oil spills.
What's going to happen? I mean, it's bad enough and they're going to compound it.
We're addressing that concern right now through legal channels.
Good. And number two is, it's my understanding that Exxon and the EPA has their information will not release the components of the dispersant.
That information is considered proprietary by the company who makes them. I have tried for the past several months to get that information. They won't release it because it's considered industrial proprietary.
I
I think we will stop the formal press conference now, but certainly everybody up here will be available for individual questions, and I appreciate all your time. There are press releases outside if you'd like a written statement.
This is Dave Hammack at the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom in Valdez, Alaska. We've just heard the rather boisterous conclusion of a press conference hosted by a consortium of environmental groups and environmental interests. As announced earlier, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, Earth First, Trustees for Alaska, the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance, and actually there are about four or five other environmental organizations, not all of whom had been posted on the advance notice of the conference. We heard a variety of concerns, and we've also heard a variety of demands, ranging from calls for support, long-term assessment, and ranging all the way to demands to stop tanker traffic, shut down the pipeline, and many of the groups are unified in calling for a ban on the development of ANWR and offshore leasing in Bristol Bay, and some of the groups went so far as to demand a ban of all offshore oil leasing and exploratory drilling. This is has been one and another of the ongoing press briefings and conferences in Valdez relating to the grounding of the tanker Exxon Valdez and the subsequent oil spill. We are into the sixth day of the incident. Of course, it all began Good Friday morning, just after midnight. And since then, life in Valdez has certainly not been the same. A point made repeatedly by fishermen, members of the community, certainly the environmental community, is that an era of innocence for Prince William Sound seems to have ended. The sentiments expressed by the Conservation Alliance group at this press conference certainly would echo that feeling. Later today, we do anticipate having more broadcasts. We understand that the NOAA conference, in fact, what was referenced by one of the speakers earlier, has in fact been postponed until tomorrow night. If it does indeed get rescheduled for tonight, we will broadcast it. The only other event we're anticipating today is a possible briefing by the Coast Guard at 4:30 and the Exxon evening press conference, which has now been officially listed as occurring at 6 p.m. I want to thank several of KCHU's staff and volunteers. Mary Beth Joyce, Laura Lee has been helping here in the facility. We've had several other volunteers in and out this morning. I want to thank those folks for their contribution. James Winchester has been anchoring these broadcasts at the station.